And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight, I guess you all know who's speaking. What a crowd. Lynn, it's been a real pleasure getting to know you recently. She put together quite an event recently. I've never seen so many volunteers pulling together and working diligently. And a lot of labor. I'm sure she's got more to say about that. I'm impressed. I'm sure you are too. You're here. Welcome, Lynn.
Wow. My name is Lynn, and I am a recovering alcoholic. Thank you for the introduction, Tim. And also, thank you to Tim, who called me a few weeks ago and asked me to share my story. I was immediately panic-stricken when he called. Well, first of all, I was glad I thought you had to be an old-timer to tell your story here on Monday night, so I'm thinking y'all made a mistake, that I had to have double digits or something. And, you know, I vacillated in my mind between... Well, as soon as he called to ask me about sharing my story, the first thing I did was start picking up the phone and calling my friends. I'm telling my story. Can you be there to support me? Which is something that I would have never done before. I've just quietly gone and told my story, and there would have been a lot of laughs and a lot of funnies in it. And it was that way when I told my story first in 2000, about 5 years at that time. But I want to thank those friends who have known me throughout my recovery, that knew me in 98 when I came in and had almost 7 years of sobriety, and who saw me go back out and struggle. I'm overwhelmed by the friends that I see in this room and for the love that they gave me when I didn't have the love to give to myself. So, I've invited probably 3/4 of you here, so thank you. I appreciate you showing up, and for the people who texted me who said they couldn't because they knew I was there. I mean, I vacillated from, like I said, that there's going to be absolutely no one here to, you know, signing CDs and tapes afterwards for everyone. To the best, Cheryl. Happy holidays. You know, I do understand what I definitely fit the egomaniac with an inferiority complex. So what I'm supposed to do is tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. If I am not into sobriety at 20 till, please, someone, say time to move on, because I need to talk about sobriety and how I was able to finally work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So what it was like for me growing up. I'm from Oklahoma. When I came, my parents had me and my brother very young. They were 20, 21. I was the oldest, of course, so I have the oldest syndrome, where I was really, really good, and my brother was really, really... He didn't follow the rules, I guess I'll say. You know, he had different rules. So I had learned very early on in my childhood that I did not want to make my mother upset. She was married to, I hate to call anyone an alcoholic, but my father was a heavy drinker. I definitely heard from her my whole life that he was an alcoholic and that he had affairs. I mean, I knew things as a child about my mother's life and about what was going on in her home that I should have never known. I can remember one time, and we were young, before 8, and thank you to my brother, who also sits in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and is here tonight. I can remember my mother tearing us up out of bed one late. It was 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and dragging us down to some saloon or those neighborhood bars, and she looked at your father. Now, we're in our pajamas. You know, my dad, honestly, he looked like he was okay and having a good time. You know, it was my mom that seemed like she was just freaking crazy with us standing there in our feety pajamas in the middle of his bar. I think he ended up staying. We ended up going back home. So it was important to her to let us me in particular know how she felt about things, and I was very, and that became one of my survival skills, knowing how to figure things out very quickly, knowing by the tone and the pitch of what her voice was, if there was going to be trouble, if my brother was in trouble, if I was in trouble. And because even though we had the alcoholic, really the center of activity happened around my mother, because she was very histrionic and very, everything was a mountain out of a molehill. So I learned how to be very calm, very collected. She would sit and tell me her problems, and I would tell her how to solve her problems. Mom, it's not that bad. You know, we can get through it. I don't have a lot of recollection of my childhood feelings. And people say, I remember this. I have events that I remember. My father was absent. And I always said to therapists from here on out that I saw, how can you miss something you never had? He left when we were in the third grade. I never had a father. I never had a sailboat. I don't miss the sailboat, and I don't miss the father. Get off the childhood stuff. You know, I'm here to talk to you about this boss I have. So I could never understand how all this childhood stuff, they kept wanting to pick away at it. So I'm the oldest. I go now to a small country school in Oklahoma. There are 36 people in my graduating senior class. So when I say a small country school, it was a small country school. I can remember, one event I remember growing up is that in the third grade, I was chosen by the class to be a mini princess in the carnival. And apparently it was a really big, big deal to my mother, who, I don't know if I ever even sold a ticket, but I know my mom sold thousands at her work and thousands everywhere that she went, everywhere we would go out in town. So it was somehow I got the message. Winning was important. I needed to be this mini princess thing, whatever that was, and win. And I also remember it very important to her that I stand out or that I'm different. And I remember that she had made this dress because everyone in the court that was dressed, only the older girls wore the long dresses. So that year, I'm the only one, of course, walking out there at 8 years old with my long prom gown on, you know, going to be carnival princess. So somehow the message to me was, stand out, be different, make sure that you win. And again, I didn't have any conscious connections of any of this. I was just, I'm being kind of, I don't know how much my parents taught me as how much was programmed or just how much I just knew this is what I need to do. I became very active in sports. So sports were... I had a natural athletic ability, so I'm a joiner. I joined a lot of things in high school and college, and I joined 4-H, and I joined band, and I joined who's who among American high school students, and who's who among the athletes. And then I also, and the people who know me well, I even joined Future Housemakers of America. Which that is... Those who know me well know why that's so funny. So I joined things. That's what I did. When I joined, then I became either I wanted to be one of the officers, because that's what you do. You want to make a difference. You want to have an impact. That's what I did. So I was kind of the kid who was the teacher's pet but didn't want to be the teacher's pet. I had friends who were always older than me. I was friends with the teachers, not so much with the classmates. I was in the in crowd, yet I always had all of the wild and crazy people at my slumber parties, because I really did like and feel connected. I liked the wild people. I liked the people who were smoking the pot on the side of the school building when I was in there, you know, off at band practice or whatever. Like I said, my brother was the one who was always getting out of things or not making his bed, and I'd make his bed so my mom wouldn't get upset. But I can remember telling him, we recently connected about 4 years ago, and we were talking about, you know, how he survived and how I survived. And he said, you know, Lynn, you know what I did. And I know what he did. He crawled out his window. My mom grounded that kid more often than anyone I've ever known. I mean, she tied him up in his room. He was tied in his room. There was a lot of verbal abuse that was going on. There was a lot of yelling and screaming. And I said, well, I know what you did, Nick. All you did was climb out your window. You can ground him. He'd climb out the window. And I said to him, why in the hell didn't you ever take me with you out the window? And he said, because you were at band practice, Lynn. And that was true. I was busy with activities. What I do remember about that time growing up also is that because of the screaming and yelling, I made a promise to myself that I would never raise my voice. Never. That I was not going to grow up screaming and yelling at people. And the second promise I made myself was that I would never apologize. I would never apologize for saying mean and hateful things to people. I would hold my tongue. So it was so contradictory for me when I got here. Restraint of pen and tongue. I was like, I do that. Because I didn't want to repeat the kinds of things I heard in my childhood. Now, my mother was my idol growing up. Through all of this, somehow all the blame got cast on the alcoholic that was in our home. And at 12 years old, my mother remarried, divorced about in the third grade. My mother remarried and married a pharmacist who happened to be an alcoholic. So now there were a couple more things into the house, and my mother started drinking more at this time. The good thing that I can say about that period is that the books that he brought into our home were fascinating. And at that time, trying to exist to make sense of my world didn't... I just knew that you do. And I can remember, and I brought them here because I was laughing. I talk a lot about Zig Ziglar and having all the self-help books, and I do. As a matter of fact, I counted them the other day because I knew I'd be doing this, and I have over 200. But when I was 12 years old, so this would have been in the early 70s, this is the stuff before Zig Ziglar, The Magic of Thinking Big, published in 52. And I was laughing because I was looking at the things that I had underlined. And it's not in self-help. I brought the book so I could remember. It's not in self-help. It's in psychology and human relationships. So self-help is about after high school, conditioning your memory. This was how I raised myself from failure to success, how to read a person like a book, how to sell yourself to others. Success is simple. The will to happiness. Now, these are things I've underlined as a 12-year-old. The other one was Norman Vincent Peale, that I was the power of positive thinking. It was $1.25 back then. And this is how my mind was shaped. Believe in yourself, how to create your own happiness. I don't believe in defeat. Power to solve personal problems. How to get people to like you. As you can see, it was very important to me that people liked me. I was constantly making sure that not only was I trying to show up and be a good person, but it was really, really important at a very early age to me that you like me. The other story that I can remember about this kind of thinking and these kind of patterns, I didn't drink until 21, 22. So I had a lot of time to cement all of these ideas, all of my ego, into believing that I absolutely had the power to create and change my world. If I wanted it bad enough, I could open up Zig Ziglar. I could open up one of these books. I could focus on the positive and not give negativity any weight in my life. And that's how I try to live. No negative. No sadness, no fear, you march through. I can remember at somewhere in my teens, we were going away to Disney World. And it was the first time we had gone away. We had a Winnebago. And, you know, I guess when you're that age, and I watch kids now, that I surely must have been excited to go to Disneyland. And we planned it forever. And my stepfather came home, and we had the car packed, or the Winnebago packed. We had all these places we were going to stay. And I remember him coming home. We were supposed to start out at early in the morning. Right, Nick? And he came home in the afternoon, one or two, and said that the yard had not been mowed. And that he wanted us to do the edging around the house and then go clean out the garden. And that's what we did. And my mom was hysterical and screaming and yelling. And I'm like, Mom, seriously, it's not that big of a deal. If we go to Disneyland, we go. If we don't, we don't. It's not that big of a problem. And from that moment earlier, I worked on conditioning myself to not thinking that things were important. Somehow believing that if I said they're not important and it doesn't matter, then it's not going to matter. So that was a big event growing up. We had a dog who died in our house that nothing was ever said. It was my pet poodle, and it had a really awful death. It had suffocated in the car, and my poor brother had accidentally put the dog in there and had forgotten. And all I can remember about that experience, and the only thing that was said to me, is when we found him after the weekend, is my mother pulling me aside, and I sat on the curb, and she said, "Don't say anything to your brother. He feels so bad about it." And I never said anything to my brother, and I cried hysterically, probably with her, but from then on out, I hid my pain or my sadness from her. My mother just seemed incapable of being able to handle any kind of emotional response I might have. She just seemed like she needed me a whole heck of a lot more than I needed her. So anytime I was hurt, anytime I had a problem, I would self-improve and find the answer myself. And there was this big fear in me that my brother was sent away to military school. So what it looked like in my family is that if there were problems, you got sent away. And I did not want to be sent away. What I knew I needed to do was agree with my mother and agree with whatever the rules were in our house, and that's what I did. So from there, graduating from a class of 36, valedictorian, all of the honors, I go to the University of Oklahoma with 7,000 enrolling freshmen. I don't remember being terrified because you just push through, and I'm sure I must have been. And this was my first conscious moment of self that I remember having, and I was 19 years old. And I remember going to college and thinking, how am I going to make it here? How am I going to stand out? How am I going to be important? I just didn't know how I was going to do it. And I remember talking to a friend of mine saying, "Do you ever wish that you were just somebody else? Do you ever wish, I have this dream that I'm on a motorcycle, I have tattoos, and I'm in Europe?" Because I was such this little, you have to study, and you have to do it by the book, and you have to do it right, and you have to be perfect, and then you always have to be happy. And that was my first moment of clarity about, I've created a box for myself. How am I ever going to get out of this box that I've created for myself? Then I pushed it away. And then I did what I did, and that was I had joined a sorority, and I asked, of course, my sorority sister was a top 10 freshman, and I said, "What do I need to do to be a top 10 freshman on this campus? What is it? Give it to me. What do I got to do?" She told me what I needed to do, and I got busy. I joined student government. I had a 4-point average that first semester. I was on campus activities council, and I was a co-chair on student government, and I was a top 10 freshman. And from there, I ended up getting a degree in journalism, and I can remember this as though it were yesterday. I had no idea what I wanted to do. As far as the degree, awards is really what I was seeking. And I can remember saying, what is the degree with the least amount of math? I hate math. Okay, narrowed all that down. Then I remember, I know what it was. I came back and I told my big sis that I wanted to be a teacher. I love children. I would love to teach. And I remember her saying that that was too easy of a degree for me to become a top 10 freshman, that I would need something with more meat to it. Okay, I'll change that. And I remember walking into my first journalism class, and I remember him saying, "In journalism, we do not care how you feel. We only care about what you see, what you have experienced, and what you can film." And I thought, this is the place for me. Feelings don't matter. They only wanted facts, and that's all I wanted to deal with, was the facts of my life. I didn't have any place for feelings. You just push through them. So I go on. At this time, I'm still not drinking. I'm a busyaholic, and my calendar is crazy at school, but I stayed busy in college. And then what happened at 21, and I say this only because my drinking went hand in hand with this experience, and I think it's important that I share it. At 21, I had my first experience. Interesting enough, the guys I dated, I was so busy with career and making these things happen in college that I really did not like drinking. As a matter of fact, my first drink in college, I can remember saying, I don't like how this makes me feel. I feel out of control. I feel out of control and I don't like it. And I stayed away from it. And that was one of the ways that I always could not identify with people in AA. And it's a way that I made differences because I didn't like it. I didn't like feeling out of control. Until a few years later. At 21, I picked up and it went hand in hand with an experience of a different lifestyle. And I could not believe that the perfect girl with the perfect resume, with the perfect titles, with the perfect awards and all the trophies, that could be on my list as well. And it became what you guys talk about in here, a secret. And no one knew about it. I got shingles my senior year. And I just thought it was something that I would take to my grave and never allow myself to go any further than that experience. So, I'm drinking. I'm only experiencing this lifestyle change when I am drinking. I am getting more and more. I'm president of my sorority, of course. I'm winding down my last semester because I'm ahead. Of course, I'm ahead. I have to. I have one class my last semester. One freaking class my last semester. I know every happy hour in town. I know where the 3-for-1s are, where the 6-for-1s are, where I can go to get the drink. And by this time, people are coming to me in the sorority house going, hey, what time does Zanzibar have their happy hour, Lynn? And I felt really proud that I had a typed out list. And that's back in the day before computers. You know, I had to really sit there and make sure with my whiteout and stuff that I had the list right. So people were coming to me with the drinking, wanting to know where it was. My drinking is progressing, but it's still under control. I graduate. And again, I graduate. They chose 10 graduating seniors from the University of Oklahoma that represented the best of the best. And it was called the Letsizer Award. And there were 3 women that were chosen. And there were 7 men. I was a little upset about that. And I can remember thinking, I don't deserve to be up here. I don't deserve to be up here. I was one of the 3 women. And then they gave 3 medals out to the gold, silver, bronze. And I remember thinking, I've got to have one of those. I've got to have one of those. I don't deserve to be up here, but I have to have a medal. I absolutely have to have one of the medals. I didn't get one. But that idea of feeling somehow like you're going to find out who I am, that idea of, you know, I've quoted before about there's only one thing worse than being a failure, and that's being a success and still believing you're a failure. And it's the same as there's only one thing worse than being kind and sweet, and that's being kind and sweet and not believing you are, or being intelligent and not believing you're intelligent enough. And those were some things that I was dealing with and not having the words for it until years later. So after graduation, I know I need to get my drinking under control. I take a job in the Northeast. My sorority contacts me because I'd hosted a national convention, and I was a director for them in the Northeast, and I traveled around to all the places up there, and that would start a lifelong of me supervising people, me being able to troubleshoot, me being able to communicate through different states, and just being, to some extent, my own boss. I liked being my own boss. So I am now with Hi-Fi. I'm there. I'm drinking a lot. But those women at Rensselaer drank a lot, too. I don't know if you know any. They partied hard, and they drank hard. It was a very studious campus. I knew that when I was there for graduation, and President Reagan had sent a letter thanking them for the moon machine that they had helped send up or something. So I'm in New York. I'm this girl from Oklahoma. I'm like, how? Me. I'm here. What now am I going to do? And National called me, and it's the first time of yet a long string of interventions into my life. And they said to me in 1986, Lynn, we're concerned. We think you might have an allergy to alcohol. Is it how I look? Is it how I dress? No. Nothing like that. So what would go on then from there is I would I'd have to leave Oklahoma because, of course, there were no people like me in Oklahoma. And I went to the place where there would be people like me, and that was California and Los Angeles. And I went out there, and I decided to use my journalism degree. And I went to work for Vogue magazine. And I was the assistant to the editor of Vogue magazine on the West Coast. It was a prime job. It was a great job. I'm working in Beverly Hills on Doheny Drive. I buy myself a Fiero. Do you remember the Fieros? It was a hot little car. But you don't know. I mean, it's a little two-seater, low to the ground. So I've got it going on. And the whole time I'm there, and I'm working for Condé Nast, and I'm in Beverly, I'm like, how does the girl from Oklahoma get here? And I'm drinking more, and I'm drinking more because I'm panicked. And I can remember I had an intervention, and so I had a long string of interventions. My jobs really like me, and they'll have an intervention because I'm a good worker. And then I will blow it yet one more time. And my last day at Vogue magazine, I'd had the intervention. I came back drunk. And I will never forget, I was standing there, and they said, Lynn, you've got to go home. And I have on my monochromatic silk three-piece suit, got my animal skin shoes on with my matching bag. And they're like, you're going to have to leave and then come back. So I did what any drunk would do. First of all, I forgot I didn't have my keys. I went out to the car and to the parking deck on the seventh floor, and I proceeded to crawl my silk suit underneath that Fiero for a nap. It was the only place I could go. I took a nap under that Fiero until everyone started coming out at 5 o'clock and the engines were starting, and I thought, what in the world? I crawled back out with grease stains on my suit and walked back into Vogue magazine to get my keys and leave. And I go through experience after experience of jobs like that who intervene. I went to Stepping Stones. I took myself into Stepping Stones, a halfway house. I remember comparing while I was there. I remember watching a girl detox. I'm out in California at this time. And I thought, and she's crying, please don't hate me. Please don't hate me. I'm such a bad person. And I remember thinking, oh, you poor little thing. You're not bad. I mean, I'm here, and I'm at Stepping Stones. And I'll tell you, I came in during the week on a Tuesday or Wednesday, and this is no joke. You can't make this stuff up. I was the president of that halfway house on Sunday when they had elections. I'm not kidding you. I'm helping policy and procedure because all these people are so much more worse off than I am, and they obviously need a leader. So I'm there to help. And just this constant idea of helping others before I can help myself, comparing that I'm not as bad as you, and looking at, oh, those poor people in AA. So I was president of Stepping Stones, and I remember feeling very bad for that girl. That never went away from me. And years later, I would always talk about, after that time from Stepping Stones, I ended up putting together 6.5 years of sobriety without AA. And I say that because I put a year and then I drank. I put a year and drank, year drank. I had 2.5 years, never using the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, always using self-will, determination. And I was a periodic binge drinker. Periodic binge, and I'm talking way periodic, 2.5 years. And I remember always quoting page 34 at Alcoholics Anonymous saying, if there's an alcoholic, we don't think he can stay sober anything like a year. And you know, I have read that passage over several times now, and it says in there, if he is very far advanced, if he's very far advanced, he won't be able to say anything. And I was one of those with the progression of the illness. So I put together this time. I have a wonderful job. I then have another intervention. Go back to the Willow. And when I started in the Willow in 95, I went in and I got my sobriety date from the Willow was 3-3 of 95. And that started the first time where my therapist brought a sponsor to me and said, you're going to work the steps. And I can remember being just very confused when I came into AA and started attempting to work the steps. I can remember you guys saying things like, you know, I just didn't get the book to life. I just don't know how to do it. And I'm thinking to myself, I have the books. I can help you too. I mean, honestly, I just thought that most people were ill-equipped to handle their lives on life's terms. So I would hear things like that, and I can only imagine my sponsors. I can remember telling my sponsor, Pat, I pulled her aside, and I was really worried one day, and this was probably 2-3 months into my sobriety, and I'm like, Pat, I've got to tell you something. I'm really concerned. And I'm looking around now, I have already come into the program happy, joyous, and free. Are there any other promises? I mean, you can't make this stuff up. And I meant it. And I remember there are those things, you know, that stick with you. And I remember her looking at me going, you might be happy and joyous, Lynn, but you sure as hell ain't free. You sure as hell ain't free. And I knew it meant something, but I didn't know. I also remember talking to my therapist about acceptance and telling her that it was backwards in here for me, that I accepted everything. I was able to let things roll off me, and I didn't understand what that was all about. I remember her looking at me and saying, in one of those other moments, Lynn, that's not acceptance, that's denial. And I had worked a good game of denial. Things don't matter. It doesn't bother me that we don't go here or go there. It doesn't bother me that I've blown up, you know, all these careers. You move on. You get a better job. And that was my nickname for a long time in here. It was Lucky Lynn. Because it seemed like no matter how far down I would go, I would yet rise up again. And there I was with a better job, you know, working it again to the next promotion. Oh, and making friends. I often said that those first 6.5 years here from 95 until 2001, you know, I think that AA was really, they talk about social media, social networking. You know, AA was my social network and social media. AA had it going on before Facebook did for me. I was in the middle of the friendship bed and the fellowship bed, and I built a program based on fellowship. I had lots of friends. We did a lot of things together. And you know what? During those 6 years, I don't ever recall, and some of those people are sitting here, me going to anyone with a problem and them saying, I think you should pray about it, Lynn. Have you talked to your sponsor? I'm with these people all the time. None of us are talking about that. We're just going out looking where the next dinner is, the party after the party before the party, and whose AA birthday is next. And it was great while it lasted, but, you know, I like to quote, even if you're on the right track, you're going to get run over if you just sit there. And I just sat there on the sobriety track, and I did nothing but surround myself with people in this program. The other thing I refused to do was journaling. I never liked to journal, even though I had a journalism degree. I remember telling you that. I didn't like to write. I was too close for comfort. I wanted to talk to you about what was going on, and I did. I was someone who needed outside help, and I sought outside help. They always wanted to talk about childhood, and I always wanted to talk about the boss or the work or the relationship. So 9/11 hit. The job I'd had for 7 years was gone. I decided to get out of that relationship. I'm still sober now. And I think I need a change. It devastated me. I told no one about losing my job. until I absolutely had to. I was more concerned about the people I was supervising and how they were going to transition, and the people I brought into the company, how was I going to live with myself, that I just recruited all these people in and now I was letting them go. 9/11 hit, they lost their jobs on the 22nd, and I had to call up 17 people and tell them their job was gone. And I never once thought about myself. I thought, I'll be okay. I struggle with sobriety. On my 40th birthday, I'm going in and out, and in my 40th birthday, I remember looking around, and I had a life filled with AA, like I told you, and I need to get sober. And that 40th birthday party, there was only two people there that were sober. And then the rest of the people were bringing me wine. I totally changed my lifestyle. I was dating someone outside the program, the first time I had done that. And I didn't even know what life it was. I remember drinking after that 40th birthday party. And I put myself into treatment. I go and get sober for a while. And then I get a job. And then my job becomes my higher power. I then go and put myself in treatment. I get a better job. I have an intervention. And I want to say something about those of us who are real, real hard workers. I know that I hear a lot of people in here talk about that they had job, they never were fired from a job because they never went to work drunk. They stayed home with a hangover. They stayed home because they didn't want to be fired. You know what? I was just more dedicated than most of you. I knew I had a job. I knew that people needed me. And I showed up drunk for work because there was a job to be done. And that's why I was actually fired from so many jobs, was because I just had a really great work ethic. And you guys, you know, were at home with a hangover. Boo-hoo. In 2005, I'm at the peak of a job again with a company. I'm the change maker, the rainmaker. I'm all things to this company. I've been skyrocketed into a new dimension. And I decide to pick up a drink after 2.5 years. I pulled together 2.5 years again, and I got a DUI. So the thing that made me different, now I have the DUI. From the DUI, it then goes on to trying to stop and start and stop and start. And those periods now are 6 months, 8 months, 4 weeks, 2 weeks, 1 week. And I was the kind of drinker, Marilyn and I have talked about this, I was the kind of drinker at the end in my binging, that I was drinking a gallon of vodka a day. I was drinking around the clock because I could no longer pass out anymore. I can remember dragging myself up to the Shell station, thinking, you've got to get up there. You've got to get up there. The Steel Reserve, the alcohol places aren't open, but that Steel Reserve is up there. And if you just get to it, you know you're going to throw it up. And I was okay with that. I'm just going to throw it up. That's what you do so you can get to the vodka. Me. I crawl up there, I get the Steel Reserve, and I can remember hovering over the grate and the floor because I was so sick and I couldn't stand up, and I would just start vomiting into the grate. And grateful that the shake stopped and the liquor store would be open soon. And I could go get my vodka again. By this time, I just feel that I'm hopeless. And the spiraling, my drinking, I know about AA. I can't seem to get sober. I put myself in treatment centers. I now believe that I'm hopeless and helpless and beyond ever getting sober. And the scariest part of all is I didn't care. I'd lost hope. So when I walked back into Alcoholics Anonymous, when I walked back in here, my last day of drinking, I called my mother on January the 13th and told her, it's not your fault. I can't go on anymore like this because I'm suicidal now. I've been placed in the crazy ward. I have I had a psychiatrist who actually sent me a note who said I was no longer welcome in his office until I had a year of sobriety, and I had to have it signed by my sponsor. I don't know if anyone's been banned from their psychiatrist's office. And I tell my mom it's not her fault, and I proceed to put myself in my trash can, because that's pretty much what I thought of myself. And I put myself in the trash can, and I have a very steep driveway, and I try to roll myself down the driveway into the street of Claremont. It's a very busy road, because I thought that no one would hit a person if I jumped out, but they might hit a trash can. So I try to roll myself down, and thank God for stick square trash cans. That thing was so hard to get from boom to boom. Had I had a round one, I would have been off in Claremont. I wouldn't be standing up here, but it was square. And it was so hard to move, and I was vomiting inside the trash can. And it just wouldn't roll. And my neighbor, who'd seen God knows what all in the last 2.5 years, my neighbor came out and said, "What's going on?" And he'd seen some crazy shit. I said, "I fell. I tripped." So I pulled myself out of the trash can, put it back, because that's what good people do. They put the trash can back where it belongs. And my mother called someone, and they came to get me. And, you know, when people ask me what changed, I would say, what didn't change for me? What didn't change when I came back? I was broken and beaten, and I had no answers and no amount. The scariest thing for me was that I lost hope. This person with such drive, with such inspiration to motivate others, I couldn't motivate myself to get up out of the bed. And I didn't care. So I got a sponsor, and we started working these steps, and I started chasing my recovery like my life depended on it, because it did. And in the first year of my sobriety, all I could think of is that I wanted a different past, because I never saw how my experience could benefit others. And why had God punished me like this? And Lane would say to me every single day, "Today is your new history, Lynn. Today is your new history." And she would say to me, "It's not, Lynn, how far you have to go. It's how far you've come." And I would remind myself that I was in that trash can. And every year I pick up a chip, I remind myself where I was. Because if I don't remember where I was, I am that kind of alcoholic that will pick it back up again and again because I feel I'm going to master it or that I just don't care. So I come in, I'm beaten, I'm done. And remember Mar, I've gone to Mar and they gave me a great thing. They said, they put your life up on this screen at Mar and they go through your whole life and all the clinicians that are there. I probably shouldn't be telling this. Okay, it's a big secret there, sorry. But your whole life, I had to write my life story and there it is. And I'm bawling because I really believe, and I'm sitting there crying with them saying, I'm constitutionally capable. I just wish someone would put me out of my misery. And I remember them saying to me, "Lynn, you've got 16 clinicians around here telling you you can get sober. And your thought and your belief is more important than all of ours. And we're the experts." And that stayed with me. Somehow I had to find some hope, and I crawled back into Alcoholics Anonymous. And my friends had had interventions. I'd had interventions and detoxes and ambulance rides. And that's another hole. I need another 2 hours for that. But I came in, and I was just willing to do anything, and I started journaling, and I started getting in touch with that 5 months of sobriety. In 1995, I wrote in my journal, and the only reason I know, it must have been an odd day, I wrote, "I'm running from sadness, fear, and anger, and I have no idea why." And for 7 years, I stayed disconnected from sadness, fear, and anger. And when I came back this time, there was nothing left in me but sadness, fear, and anger. And that was the work that I needed to do. I needed to get into the ring with myself and duke it out. All the things that I thought were my beliefs, world should be fair, it's my job to make it fair. Not my job to make it fair. So what's different today is I have a program of action. I am active. I look at where my feet are. I came in, and Lisa was hosting a Christmas party that year, and I signed myself up to get involved in AA activities because, see, I'd never done service work. I hung around. I had a sponsee. I thought that was service work. No. I came in and started giving back to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that had so freely given to me when I came here and had no hope and no life and didn't know if I wanted a life. I remember that Debbie was the president of the clubhouse here, and at a month of sobriety, I said, I'll do the Valentine's party, and I hung up decorations in here. I volunteered down at the cafeteria. I got involved in the step meeting, of all things. I went to meetings where my friends weren't hanging out. I went and found a recovery program for Lynn and steps that I could work. I found a sponsor that I wasn't afraid to say. You know, for me, I needed to take my big girl panties off. I need to take them off and say, this hurts, I'm sad, I'm angry. None of this stiff upper lip stuff for me, it wasn't working. That's what got me in the trouble I was in. So I started giving back. I started working with others. I realized that through the steps I had to outline things like, what did it mean to be spiritually fit? It's like, if I can't define what spiritually fit is, how do I know if I am spiritually fit? You know, when I came in before, spiritually fit to me was, I've got a God. He's a good God. He's a nice God, doing the sun and the planets and the big stuff. And I love God, and God loves me. But I didn't have a relationship with a God. And today, I do have a relationship with my higher power. I choose to use Santa Claus as my higher power, who I call my God. But because for me, that's probably one of the most purest forms of a person that I can remember in my household. There was nothing bad ever said about Santa Claus. Santa Claus always got you what you wanted. Santa Claus was sweet and nice. No one ever had anything bad to say about Santa Claus. Not even my mother. So I'm thinking that's going to be the higher power that I use. The first year, I didn't think I was going to make it. And at 10 months, I started getting really sick, and I didn't understand what was going on. Let me backtrack here. The friends who showed up for me during all of the interventions, who came and cleaned my house, and my house looked like I might as well have been living on the streets. I had 2x4s up on all the windows. I had blankets up on the windows. It was trashed. And I had people in this room that came and cleaned my cat box and came and gave me mashed potatoes when I probably hadn't eaten for a week, and who really tried to just keep an eye out on me. And for those people who were here when I still got back and said, we're glad to see you. You know, and it's people who aren't even in my closest of close networks. People like Judy and Chris and Cheryl, although Cheryl and I do a lot together, but there were people who just made me feel welcome and made me feel like it was okay that I had failed. I picked up 26 white chips in those 2 years before I got sober. 26. I knew the answer was here, I just couldn't seem to do it. So I get sick. I'm wondering what's wrong. I have a mammogram. I'm sick for about 5 months with bronchitis, and all these things are going on, and nothing is getting fixed. And at my second year of sobriety, I found out that I had breast cancer. And I have to admit, some of the old defense mechanisms went up. Don't talk about it. Trudge through. Go through it. But again, I shared in my home group. I have a home group, women that support me, because the women of Alcoholics Anonymous have saved my life. The men I love, and the men have been like big brothers to me, but the women have saved my life. So I did what you guys taught me to do. The day I found out that I had cancer, my brother was picking up a 30-day chip. I was here at a meeting I'd never been to, 9:30. That's way too early for me. And I got the call from the doctor in that meeting, in that room. And there was a woman who shared that she had just gotten out of jail and had no toiletries, and could any of us help her? And I piped up and talked to her after the meeting and said, sure, I can help you. Got the call from the doctor. And what you guys taught me is when my partner asked me, what do you want to do? I said, well, the girl doesn't have any toiletries. I guess we need to go get some toiletries for that girl. And I kept moving in Alcoholics Anonymous, trying to be of service, sharing with the sponsor, because step five was something I never did. I thought that was a one-time deal. It says in our literature, we must continue talking about our conflicts. I never saw that. I told you once, I'm done. And besides that, I don't have conflicts. I just have bad moments. I don't really have anything big going on. I had to get rid of all that crap and start sharing about what was honestly going on. I got a job at Big Lots during that time. And me and this executive, I was shoving boxes off of Big Lots. I was willing to go to any length for my sobriety. I did not need to manage people. I needed to put ketchup up on shelves and make sure there was enough mustard and Cracker Jack out there for you people coming in. So probably the biggest part of my program is steps 6 and 7, and I know I've gone over, and the maintenance of my spiritual condition. There is a list of things that I'm very clear about, my sponsor is very clear about, if I do not maintain, because that's what it says, the only thing between me and a drink is going to be my spiritual condition. But before it says spiritual condition, it says the maintenance. I never saw that word either. I needed to maintain my sobriety, like I maintain my car sometimes. And then getting into service work. I want to thank you for asking me to tell my story. I was very nervous. People know bits and pieces. There's a whole jail scene you all didn't get. I owe my life to the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, to Santa Claus, who I choose to call God, and the hope that you guys have for me, and the love that you gave so freely to me when I didn't think I could do it. And I hope, if you're sitting there and you have lost hope, whether it's in through your disease or there are problems or situations that feel too big, I feel it is my personal responsibility to have hope for the hopeless, because that's where I was, and Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. Thank you.
You may be seated.
Wow.
That was great. Nina's going to hand out the chips.
Hey, everybody. I'm Nina. And this meeting utilizes a chip system as time markers within our first year of sobriety. I was told that the first chip is the most important one. It's the white chip. It's the international sign of surrender. If you'd like to give up the high cost of low living, I invite you to come up here and grab a white chip, and we'll tell you about the rest later. Is there anybody here who'd like to pick up a white chip? After 30 days, we offer a silver chip. Is there anyone with 30 days of continuous sobriety? After 90 days, the red chip. Anyone with 90 days? The hugs are free. Anyone with 6 months? I got sober in Fort Lauderdale, and they introduced the people who get the chips, which I think is real nice. So everybody, that was Shelby. Is there anyone with 9 months of sobriety? That was Michelle. Is there anybody with 1 year of sobriety? Anyone celebrating an anniversary of their first year of sobriety? Ah! Yeah.
program. I got a sponsor. I work for Staff's Red, the big book. I'm in a three-quarterway house, so I'm very grateful for it. And I just try to live the program and not just work it. I think working is like a Monday through Friday thing, and living is like a 24-hour thing. So, thanks for coming.
We offer the white chip slice in case anyone was too shy.
Anniversary.
Oh, we do.
This is lucky number two. All right. Yeah. It's been a great year. I definitely got God and AA to thank for it. So, thank you.
Yeah. Any other blues? We offer the white chip twice. Anyone else? It's up here in case you're shy. Cherish the chips you hold.
Thank you, Nina. It's time for AA or NABA Club related announcements. Yes, Frank.
Hey, Frank. Thanksgiving, NABA has dinner downstairs at the 11 o'clock meeting. And everybody's welcome. And on December 17th, we have the kids' Christmas downstairs. So, if you want to volunteer, you can get your load. And show up for your kids.
Thank you, Frank.
I'm quite water from the carbon alcohol.
Hey, Tim.
If anybody came later, Mr. Bass, there'll be a couple on the tables in here.
Okay. If you'd like to help us break down after the meeting, we encourage. If you feel like doing a little quickie service work. And what else we got? Ella Teens on Thursday night, 8 o'clock downstairs. So if you know any teens that need to come, send them our way. Next week, we've got Laura N. from the Tri-Night Flight group of Triangle. And then Richard L. from the 7:30 NABA Early Morning Study Group. So that's the week after, that's December 5th. So please come back and join us. And if there's nothing else, I remind you that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions that remind us to place principles before personalities. For those who will, please join hands in the Lord's Prayer.
ready for the honey, ready for the wind, ready for the bell, looking for the water from a deeper well. Found some love and I found some money, found that blood would drip from the honey, found I had a thirst that I could not quell, looking for the water from a deeper well. Looking for the water from a deeper well. Looking for the water from a deeper well. Well, I did it for kicks and I did it for hate. I did it for lust and I did it for fame. Did it for need and I did it for love. Addiction stayed on tight like a glove. So I ran with the moon and I ran with the night and the three of us were a terrible sight. To the bottle, to the gun, to the cell, to the bottom of a hole, of a deeper well. My trouble down a dead end trail, reaching a hand for a holier grave. Hey there, mama, did you carry that load? Did you tell your baby about the bend in the road, about the rebel yell, about the one that fell, looking for the water from a deeper well? Hey,